Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of the Democratic presidential race going forward following Senator Bernie Sanders' blowout victory over Hillary Clinton in the New Hampshire primary. Robert Kuttner, the co-founder and co-editor of The American Prospect, joins us to discuss his article at the Huffington Post, Generation Sanders, and the growing divide between the Democratic and Republican political establishments and political insurgents like Donald Trump on the right and Bernie Sanders on the left, who continue to defy conventional wisdom in this year of the outsider. Then we'll hear from a whistleblower at the EPA, Marsha Coleman Adebayo, who served as the executive secretary of the EPA's Environmental Working Group and is the author of No Fear, A Whistleblower's Triumph Over Corruption and Retaliation at the EPA. We will discuss her article at The Guardian, Water Crises Like Flint Will Continue Until the EPA is Held Accountable, and the culture at the EPA of regulatory capture that explains why a top EPA official covered up the lead poisoning crisis in Flint, Michigan, which turned out to be the tip of the iceberg as we learn that many more cities across the country are poisoning their residents with lead-tainted water. Then finally, we'll examine the implications of the Supreme Court's decision to halt the implementation of the EPA's Clean Power Plan until legal challenges from a number of states are resolved. David Arkush, the Managing Director of the Public Citizens Climate Program, joins us to discuss this blow to the Obama administration's efforts to phase out coal-burning power plants, which will delay progress in dealing with climate change at a time when more assertive action is needed. And joining us now is Robert Kuttner, the co-founder and co-editor of The American Prospect. He was formerly an assistant to the legendary I.F. Stone and a chief investigator for the Senate Banking Committee. His books include A Presidency in Peril, The Insider Story of Obama's Promise, Wall Street's Power, and the Struggle to Control Our Economic Future. And his latest book is Debtor's Prison, The Politics of Austerity versus Possibility. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, Generation Sanders. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Kuttner.
Always a pleasure, Ian.
And Generation Sanders, of course, is celebrating this blowout victory. I think it's actually an historic high in terms of how many points Bernie Sanders won by over Hillary Clinton. However, the irony is at this point, Hillary Clinton has more delegates because of this superdelegate, what should we call it, arrangement?
Right.
So go figure.
Well, I am just astonished, and I have to say, I've been writing for about 6 months that I think Sanders is going to do a lot better than people expected because there's such economic frustration with the status quo, and Hillary is the representative of the status quo. It's the worst possible year to be the representative of experience and continuity. I think Jeb Bush, in a sense, suffers from that because he's associated with two prior presidents. People are sick of this, and the economic anxiety can go right, it can go left, but I still find it amazing, given the fact that Bernie Sanders is 75 years old. He's an identified Democratic socialist. He's a Jewish atheist. The fact that he did so extraordinarily well is a testament, A, to his own integrity, and B, to the economic frustration that's gripping the country. One of the most notable findings from the polls is that even people who disagree with Sanders find him a trustworthy, honorable, honest man. And in this political climate, that counts for a lot. So, people ask, can he be nominated? Can he be elected? I certainly don't know. But I think anybody who believes that he's going to run into this Hillary firewall, I think, is underestimating the potential of what's occurring.
But it does seem to be a different kind of roiling angst out there in terms of, you know, Bernie Sanders often talks about revolution. He's sort of qualified that a little by referring to it as a political revolution. But this growing divide between the Democratic and the Republican political establishments that's made clear by the political insurgents on the right, Donald Trump, and on the left, Bernie Sanders, obviously they continually defy conventional wisdom. And this is clearly the year of the outsider. But my sense is that this is an unusual kind of revolution. Normally, you know, you have revolutions from the right that come from the top down and from the left that come from the bottom up, from the working classes, if you will. This seems to be a middle-class revolution. Would you agree with that?
Well, I think the difference between right-wing populism that Trump represents and left-wing populism is that right-wing populists, and in this case it's both middle-class and working-class, blame government, they blame foreigners, and classic left-wing populism blames capitalism or blames the banking elites. I think the Sanders version of populism has the virtue of being true. This is not the fault of foreigners. It's not the fault of government, except to the extent that government has been captured by the usual suspects, the same economic elites. And it is going to be just riveting to watch how Sanders does on the Democratic side, how Trump does on the Republican side. I think my own view is that Trump's nomination is almost assured because the establishment Republicans are canceling each other out, whereas Sanders versus Clinton is going to be a real horse race. You know, you can do a chart of Sanders' vulnerabilities and Hillary's vulnerabilities, and I'm not sure which one is more vulnerable. But I think the Hillary people have overestimated her strength all along, and I think Sanders is just going to keep gaining on her.
Well, I remember talking to one of Bill Clinton's former pollsters a while back, and I suggested that Bernie Sanders was going to do very well, and maybe Hillary would be wise, if she does win, to make him the vice president, to keep all those young people in the tent and on board, since he's bringing them in to the fold. And I was almost laughed at. It was like, what are you talking about? He's a total flash in the pan. He's another Howard Dean. He's going to rise like a meteor and crash and burn.
Yeah, that's what I've been hearing all year, and people have underestimated the significance of what he represents. And it's particularly generational. And, of course, it's ironic that a 75-year-old guy would be representing young people. But I have been waiting for years and years and years for young people to put a political analysis on just how screwed they are economically. We saw a foreshadowing of this with the Occupy movement, right? But the Occupy movement was proudly anarchist in its sensibility and its strategy of organizing. And it was kind of a flash in the pan, even though it gave us a great slogan. The difference between the Occupy movement and an election campaign is that, by definition, an election campaign can't be anarchist. It has to be very well organized. And so I think the economic screwing of young people has finally found its political expression in the Sanders campaign, and that's not going away. It's just, if anything, it's continuing to build.
So what did you make, though, of in his acceptance speech, Bernie Sanders talked about the Democrats coming together in the future and being, you know, uniting, and I don't know when, it wasn't clear about when that would happen, but it seemed to be some kind of olive branch, and I wasn't quite sure what to make of it.
You know, I wouldn't make anything of it. It's the sort of thing you say. I mean, if you win a blowout victory, you are expected to be magnanimous in victory, and you are expected to say that you're going to be a unifier. So I wouldn't, it's political boilerplate. I wouldn't make anything more of it than that.
But on the Republican side, when you talk about the Republican establishment, and clearly they have been alarmed at Donald Trump, and maybe at this point, if they don't bring out their big artillery, I don't know what they can do to stop him.
Well, there is no big artillery.
That's what I was about to say. I mean, if you bring out George W. Bush, that's not going to work, right?
Well, there are no smoke-filled rooms anymore. There are no establishment Republicans who have a great deal of credibility. I mean, Bush's historical moment is over. And, of course, he's the brother of a candidate who seems to be crashing and burning. So there is no Republican with the popularity and the credibility to stand up and say, look, guys, somebody, whether it's Kasich or Bush or Rubio, needs to be the anti-Trump, and the rest of you need to politely go home. That's not going to happen. And this is going to go into March before it winnows down. We're not clear who it's going to winnow down to. You know, you can tell a story whereby it winnows down to Trump versus Cruz, except that Cruz is the sort of evangelical who doesn't play all that well in the moderate states of the North. You can say it's going to winnow down to Trump versus Bush, except Bush keeps not gaining very much traction. It looked like the anti-Trump was going to be Rubio, but Rubio crashed and burned, so this is going to go on for a while. And Kasich, he's a far-right conservative, but he's not a hater, and so he's not far-right enough for the Tea Parties. I think New Hampshire was his moment. I think he's going to have much, much tougher time in the South. So this is the worst nightmare of the Republican establishment, because you've got four different guys duking it out, and none of them is going to go home anytime soon.
But what about this conventional wisdom that only white people have voted so far, and that when minorities in Nevada and in South Carolina vote, it's going to be a different picture in terms of Bernie Sanders versus Hillary Clinton?
Well, Sanders, you know, yes, started out as a white guy from a very white state, but he's been picking up black endorsements. He's done some very astute things like going to historically black colleges. And this is not a stupid guy. I mean, you don't get elected calling yourself a democratic socialist to the United States Senate unless you're very shrewd politically. And I think the Hillary people are kind of counting their chickens before they hatch. She'll probably win South Carolina, but I don't think it's going to be the kind of blowout that the Clinton people predict. And also, there was a particular bond that Bill Clinton had with black voters. I'm not so sure that carries over quite so effortlessly to Hillary.
Well, Bill himself seems awfully tired on the stump. He's certainly not the same Bill Clinton, who campaigned for Hillary back in 2008.
That's right, and I'm not sure how much of an asset he is because, you know, I think for younger women, the Bill sexual excesses has a kind of a different meaning than it does for older people. You know, for our generation, we associate Monica and all of those scandals with the right-wing hatchet job on Bill and the kind of trumped-up impeachment and all that stuff. I think during the last few years, there's a whole new sensibility about sexual harassment, sexual violence, rape. And I think younger women are more inclined to see Hillary as someone who excused or apologized or even, in a strange way, enabled some of Bill's sexual excesses. And that impeaches her credibility as a feminist. So I think she's vulnerable in multiple ways. And I think, meanwhile, the minority support for Bernie is only going to grow.
But in terms of what I mentioned at the beginning, Robert Kuttner, this anomaly with superdelegates, where Bernie Sanders won 60% of the vote in New Hampshire, but he's ended up with 13 delegates while Hillary Clinton has 15, because of the superdelegates, there are eight of them, six are committed to Hillary Clinton, and the other two are undecided. If that kind of inside establishment play continues throughout this election, isn't that just going to embitter Bernie's people even more?
And if no, I don't think so. Look, Hillary starts out with something like 300 superdelegates because she's gotten pledges from all of the elected officials who get to the convention because they're elected officials.
Actually, 400, 394.
Yeah, okay. And a few of them will be for Bernie. So it's 300 and change out of more than 2,000 delegates. So it just means that he's got to win a disproportionate share of the primary delegates, but, you know, he's going to continue to try and do that. And by the way, some superdelegates might even change their minds.
Well, it does seem that maybe we're only seeing the beginning of the revolution. You know, certainly it doesn't seem to be peaking, does it?
No, and it's going to take about 2 months for us to get a sense of which way this is going. I mean, you've got Super Tuesday, but you've also got on Super Tuesday states that could be Sanders states like Minnesota and Massachusetts that have a lot of delegates. And then you got the huge states like New York and California, where you can easily imagine Sanders carrying those states. And so this is going to go on for a while. I mean, the idea that Hillary has a firewall, she's going to shut him down on Super Tuesday, I don't think that's going to happen, in part because I don't think that, you know, the African-American support for Hillary is quite as locked down as Hillary supporters think that it is.
Well, just in closing, trying to analyze what's happening on the other side with Donald Trump, my sense is that his appeal is largely based upon the fact that he is not a politician. And my sense is that this is the year when the electorate has woken up to the fact that they hate politicians. They just think they're a bunch of – all they do is talk, which is what Trump says. They're full of talk. They don't do anything, you know. And is that possibly going on, that people are just fed up with listening to politicians? Because, frankly, they all do sound the same except for Bernie, which is an interesting anomaly.
Well, the other anomaly is that, you know, here's a billionaire – who says, well, I have so much money that I can't be bought, I don't have to raise money from special interests. And perversely, that impresses some people. And the fact that he's a successful businessman, even though he went bankrupt a few times, that impresses people. And the fact that he is so blunt to the point of absolute crudeness, that impresses some people. And it just tells you how fed up the American public is with politics as usual.
Well, Robert Cartner, I thank you very much for joining us.
Pleasure being with you. Take care, Ian.
You too. Thanks a lot. And again, I've been speaking with Robert Cartner, who's the co-founder and co-editor of The American Prospect. He was formerly an assistant to the legendary I.F. Stone and a chief investigator for the Senate Banking Committee. His books include A Presidency in Peril, The Insider Story of Obama's Promise, Wall Street's Power, and the Struggle to Control Our Economic Future. And his latest book is Debtor's Prison, The Politics of Austerity versus Possibility. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, Generation Sanders. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back hearing from a whistleblower at the EPA explaining why the EPA betrayed the citizens of Flint, Michigan.
What's happened to the water? Our water's going bad. Oceans, rivers, lakes, and streams have all been touched by man. Poison floating out to sea now threatens life on.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Marsha Coleman Adebayo, who's the founder and president of the No Fear Institute. She served as the executive secretary of the EPA's Environmental Working Group. Her victory in a Title VII complaint of the 1964 Civil Rights Act in Coleman Adebayo versus Carol Browner inspired the passage of the No Fear Act of 2002. She's the author of No Fear, A Whistleblower's Triumph Over Corruption and Retaliation at the EPA, and she has an article at The Guardian, Water Crises Like Flint's Will Continue Until the EPA is Held Accountable. Welcome to Background Briefing, Marsha Coleman Adebayo.
Thank you very much for having me.
And I guess before we begin, Marsha, we have to at least put some context here, given the decision yesterday by the U.S. Supreme Court to halt the implementation of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency's Clean Power Plan until these legal challenges from the states are resolved. This, of course, is a blow to the Obama administration and a blow to the clean air and efforts to curb global warming and climate change. Nevertheless, it's happening, and I guess in a way we need the EPA in the sense that they're the ones that are being blocked by the Supreme Court, which I suppose what it comes down to, Marsha, there are things worse than the EPA, right?
That's an interesting dichotomy, I suppose. I suppose my position is a bit different. It's like you're holding up two dirty glasses of water and saying which one is better to drink out of. And I guess my position would be neither, really, that we need a clean glass of water and not just simply to compare two dirty glasses of water. The problem with the EPA is that the culture of the agency does not allow employees who are really interested in protecting the environment to do their work. And so you have situations like Flint, you know, where EPA employees are not even blowing the whistle. I mean, they're just doing their job and saying, you know, our tests have determined that there's an unacceptable, level of lead in the water, and you have EPA, because of its culture and because of its relationship with commerce and other structural problems within the agency, basically clamping down on the employee, maligning the employee, and basically, you know, assigning the employee to a closet somewhere so that he can no longer do his job. So I think your dichotomy is a bit off in that sense, because I think that we're in a very serious situation with the EPA, where if we don't sort of create a new almost institution that protects the environment for people, we're going to continue to have more Flint-like situations throughout the country.
Well, we've got a Flint-like situation here in Los Angeles with the methane leak that's been going on since October, and that coupled with what happened in Flint. And then if you go back, of course, to the BP blowout in the Gulf, which was a massive environmental catastrophe, what emerged from that was that the agency in charge of protecting the public from blowouts from oil drilling, the Minerals Management Agency, turned out to be captured by the oil industry. And in effect, this phenomenon is known as regulatory capture. Mm-hmm. Would you say that the EPA has also been captured by the very people that they're supposed to monitor?
Well, that is the problem, isn't it? Is that we have a government that does not distinguish between serving the people and serving commerce. And so even when we look at chemical analysis or we look at environmental disasters, there's always a cost-benefit analysis that's used, which determines, you know, to what extent can we protect the public without endangering commerce. And so there's never just a pure definition of let's protect the environment because that's the most important, or let's protect human health because that's at the center of our mission. There's always that balancing act between protecting human health and making sure that businesses are not unduly impacted. So we have not made public health, we've not made the environment prime, we've not put them at the top of the agenda. There's always that balancing act, and that's the problem that we're facing in Flint and other parts of the country right now, is that the priorities are wrong. You know, it's the priority of human life versus profits, and whenever you're in that kind of discussion, at some point, at least under this economy, profit usually wins out. And that means that people suffer and they die.
So I guess the work that you've done and the extent to which you became a whistleblower, and certainly what you have told us in your article at The Guardian, water crisis in Flint will continue until the EPA is held accountable. I've covered the Flint story as much as I can, and I was astounded to learn about Miguel Del Toril, the EPA guy, who you say was not a whistleblower, but he's just doing his job. And
he became a whistleblower.
Right, right.
But because as I say in my book, whistleblowers are not born, they're made. And it's the material conditions under which you are forced to operate that makes you a whistleblower. So at first he was just doing his job. And I'm sure Miguel, just like myself, was absolutely astounded when EPA basically, presented us with, you know, this direct order to shut up and not do our work. So So in that sense, the culture is very consistent at EPA, that if you're silent and you just sort of go along to get along, you know, you keep getting promoted and sort of the bottom keeps sort of rising to the top. But if you're someone like Miguel and you sound the alarm, then I think EPA whistleblowers across the board will tell you that, you know, you're at some point called into an office and told to stand down and let the people die or just look the other way while some disaster is taking place.
And again, I'm speaking with Marcia Coleman Adebayo, who's a founder and president of the No Fear Institute. She served as the executive secretary of the EPA's Environmental Working Group, and her victory in the Title VII complaint of the 1964 Civil Rights Act in Coleman Adebayo versus Carol Browner inspired the passage of the No Fear Act of 2002. She's the author of No Fear, A Whistleblower's Triumph Over Corruption and Retaliation at the EPA, and she has an article at The Guardian, Water Crises Like Flint's Will Continue Until the EPA is Held Accountable. So let's then zero in on the political appointee in charge of the 5th District, who was the one who basically put Miguel del Toral in the closet and told him to shut up, and told the Michigan environmental people who Miguel had warned about the toxic levels of lead in the water in Flint. She said, disregard his findings. They're premature. It's an extraordinary thing. I still can't get my head around it. So explain to me how that culture works. Why would somebody that the Obama administration put in charge of this 5th district of the EPA have that kind of mentality and mindset that she was actually working for the people who are covering up a massive public health crisis and not working for the people of the United States and in particular the citizens of Flint, Michigan?
Well, what I argue in my paper is that we just simply can't look at sort of the sacrificial lamb, which is Susan Hedman, that we have to look at the head of the EPA, Gina McCarthy. I mean, that's really sort of the goal of this paper, is to say, you know, when we keep looking at regional administrators and assistants to assistant administrators and all the little people, and I suppose at some point they understand their role is to sort of slide under the bus when these kinds of situations occur. But it seems impossible to me, after working at the EPA, that the head of the organization, who is essentially Ms. Hedman's boss, Gina McCarthy, would not have known that either her employee, her subordinate, was incredibly incompetent, or she was following orders. And so one of the things that we've been pressing the Congress to do is to subpoena the email traffic between the head of the EPA and Ms. Hedman, because we have to know, what did she know? That this is the head of the EPA. What did she know, and when did she know it? So I think this story is a bit larger than Susan Hedman. I mean, she's the one who's, you know, she's been fired. But I think that's also, if you don't mind me just sort of deviating a bit, it's also instructive about EPA culture in terms of what happened when she was fired. There's a community where, you know, tens of, perhaps thousands of children will, in fact, their children and their grandchildren will suffer from lead poisoning, will never reach their God-given potential because of the lead in their brains. And how did the EPA respond to that in terms of Susan Hedman? Well, they just allowed her to politely walk out the door and retire. Isn't that interesting? Someone who is responsible for such an abhorrent criminal act is just simply allowed to just retire with her pension and all of her benefits and just simply walk out the door. So what that says in a very real sense is that there are two different systems of justice in this country. We've got young men in prison right now for, you know, possessing one or two joints, and they're serving 10, 20 years in prison. And here is a woman who is responsible, if you take the news reports on face value, for such abhorrent pollution that maybe two, three, four generations, maybe more, will be basically assigned, you know, lower IQs. They'll have all kinds of medical problems. We have people in Flint now who can literally pull out their teeth by just pulling down on the tooth. Their hair is falling out, and she's allowed simply to walk out the door and retire with all of her benefits. That's the kind of culture I'm talking about in the federal government that must be exposed, and I think it's important for the American people to make a statement about whether or not they think that's fair, that we have people who are able to devastate whole communities, destroy whole communities, and are just simply allowed to retire.
Well, I'm curious then, Marsha Coleman Adebayo, how far up the chain does this collusion go? If you say that Susan Hedman, the head of the EPA 5th District, who covered up the report from her subordinate, Miguel Del Toral, and should be held criminally liable, as should the Governor Snyder of Michigan for creating
exactly.
the crisis in the first place. And then you go up the chain to Gina McCarthy, that she's also compromised. Well, does that mean then that Barack Obama, who chose her, is compromised? Does it mean in the woman that you sued, the head of the EPA, Carol Browner, was Bill Clinton who appointed her compromised?
Yeah, I think it's important to ask the same question they asked at Watergate. What did they know, and when did they know it? And I don't think there are any sacred cows in this situation. We have injured children, so we have to know how far did this go up the chain. And we won't know that unless Congress is courageous enough to ask the very questions they asked around Watergate. What did they know, and when did they know it? So I'm not opposed to anyone's emails being subpoenaed and trying to track down what did they know and when did they know it. We have to have that information because we have an entire community that's been destroyed, wiped off the face, I mean, mentally. So when I was at the hearing last week, I tell the story in the Guardian article about this incredibly brave, courageous Virginia Tech professor named Mark Edwards. And he was the same professor who also exposed the lead poisoning in Washington, D.C., and he's been maligned, and the EPA and the CDC have tried to characterize him as crazy and all kinds of, you know, little adjectives that they use when they want to discredit people, but it really hasn't stopped him. And he's sort of at the center of this story as well, because the people of Flint and people around in this area sort of turned to Mark when they found out that there was a problem. And he was testifying, and one of the things that he said is that the EPA in the state of Michigan had their way with the children of Flint. That is such powerful and very loaded language, that the EPA in the state of Michigan had their way with the children of Flint. And there was a woman behind me who was holding one of these bottles of water with feces and you know, lead and everything else that these people have been drinking and bathing in for the last 2 years. And the bottle went down. And I thought she was having a heart attack because I could just hear her heaving. And then all of a sudden the sound came out. And then there was this scream. And it just sort of shook the whole chambers in the hearing. And when I turned around to look at the EPA representative, who was some low-level guy, assistant to an assistant to an assistant, and the state of Michigan person, they didn't even turn around to look at her. They just kept their eyes focused in front.
Well, we know, for example, that the state employees were told not to drink the water at a time when the state was covering up the problem. So the cynicism...
But it's worse than that, because Ford Motor Company was told, they started complaining that the water was corroding the engine and the various parts in the cars.
Right.
And they were given a different... They were given a dispensation so that they could bring water in and not pollute the cars that they were building.
Right.
But the people in Flint were still drinking and bathing in the water.
Well, but let me just clarify what I was trying to say, and that is that if we have regulatory capture, if the industry and commerce capture these agencies like the EPA, then when is the conversation had? Does when Obama appoints Susan Hedman or Gina McCarthy, the head of it, does he say, look, your job is not to protect the people of the United States. Your job is to protect commerce and industry. Or does when Gina McCarthy gets the job, is she sort of told by the bureaucracy, by the way, you may want to clean up air and water in this country, but your real job is to collude with industry? Where is the fix in?
Yeah, where is the fix in? Well, in my book, I talk about the fact that there's a very fine line between commerce and the EPA. And I think we all know it inside the agency because we come up against those lines every day. And the example that I think it's important to say that EPA, like the Department of Homeland Security, was sort of chiseled out of a number of other government departments. So when President Nixon created the Environmental Protection Agency, what he did was he took people from the Department of Interior, Department of Agriculture, and other departments, and they became sort of the first group of EPA employees. And what's important about that is that these are all agencies that have a very deep link into commerce. You have Department of Agriculture that has a very cozy relationship with the agribusiness industry. You have Department of Interior that has a very deep relationship with landowners and ranchers and plantation owners and people who are concerned about natural resources. So almost in the inception of EPA was this business public health dichotomy. It was almost born inside the creation of the EPA. There's a very good book that your listeners may want to read by Evan Valianatos, and it's called Poison Spring. And it basically goes into the history of the EPA so that you really understand that from the very beginning, EPA was always connected to industry. It was always sort of in a sweetheart relationship with chemical companies, with pesticides, herbicide companies, and they've played an amazingly, I think, destructive role in terms of I talked about the cost-benefit analysis earlier, right? So that you're constantly, even when you're looking at a regulation, you're trying to determine, well, how much is this going to cost industry? Well, opposed to being able to focus on the public health of the public.
Sure. Well, just we're running out of time. Just a quick appraisal of the fact that my understanding is now we're getting reports that there are 16 cities in Pennsylvania reporting higher levels of lead than the people in Flint were exposed to. Mm. So all across the country, there's clearly a problem with lead poisoning from old pipes. Given what's happening in the news, is there a chance that the EPA can be shamed into doing the right thing?
No, I don't think so. I don't think shame is an issue at all. I mean, I know we don't have very much time, but I'd love for your readers, your listeners, to look into a program that EPA organized, or we were the contractors for the American Chemistry Council. It was a $2.1 million program called CHEERS, in which EPA became the operational managers to test pesticides on children, on babies below 1 year old, to determine whether or not the chemical industry could actually increase the level of pesticides in household products. You see EPA as this very purist, tree-hugging agency, one has to really rethink that notion of what EPA. I think of EPA as an environmental business organization, as opposed to purely an environmental organization. And maybe the next time we talk, we can talk about how I sort of, you know, butt heads when I was, you know, when I was the environmental secretary for the Gorham-Becky Commission, and I was trying to save South African miners from the destructive mining practices in South Africa. that were being practiced by Union Carbide.
Sure. Well, look, we are out of time, but I mean, I must say what you've told us and told our audience, Marcia, makes me wonder what the hell are the Koch brothers trying to shut down the EPA, and why are all these Republican presidential candidates saying they're going to get rid of the EPA? It sounds like they've got their perfect lapdog agency. Instead of a watchdog, it's become a lapdog.
Well, we should have another discussion about that.
We definitely will, and I'm glad we talked. And thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Marcia Coleman Adebayo, who's the founder and president of the No Fear Institute. She served as the executive secretary of the EPA's Environmental Working Group, and her victory in a Title VII complaint of the 1964 Civil Rights Act in Coleman Adebayo versus Carol Browner inspired the passage of the No Fear Act of 2002. She is the author of No Fear, A Whistleblower's Triumph Over Corruption and Retaliation at the EPA, and she has an article at The Guardian, Water Crises Like Flint's Will Continue Until the EPA is Held Accountable. We're going to take a brief station break and back examining the implications of the Supreme Court's decision to halt the implementation of the EPA's Clean Power Plan. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. Joining us now is David Arkush, who's the Managing Director of Public Citizens Climate Program, an expert on consumer product safety and financial protection, access to justice, and money in politics. He has testified before Congress on environmental protection and climate change. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Arkush.
Thanks for having me on.
And the Supreme Court yesterday struck a fairly heavy blow to President Obama's efforts to get rid of one of the greatest sources of global warming gases and CO2, which is causing climate change and global warming, and that is, of course, the stationary sources of power plants that are coal-fired. So given that the Supreme Court has put a stay on the EPA's Clean Power Plan until these challenges from, I think, 26 states are resolved. The delay clearly is very concerning. But I also understand that the Supreme Court stay is unprecedented. And normally you wait for the lower courts. So that doesn't augur well for the final decision, does it?
Well, it certainly suggests that the Supreme Court thinks there's some chance that the challengers might succeed. It certainly doesn't bode well from that perspective. And you're absolutely right. It's unprecedented for the Supreme Court to essentially sort of intervene at the request of the challengers and stay this litigation while a lower court is hearing it. Now, the lower court itself, you know, sort of second highest level of court in the country, already considered the request for a stay and rejected it.
So the Supreme Court's overruling the appeals court in this 5-4 vote. And what is their justification for that?
Well, they don't give one in this kind of situation. And so all that we get is a short order saying that the case has stayed pending litigation and then noting that, in this case, noting that there were four justices who dissented and would have denied the stay. And those four justices were the liberals on the court. So we can infer that the five justices who voted to stay the case are the conservatives on the court.
And this, of course, is a victory for these 29 states that are led by West Virginia, which is led by West Virginia, whose attorney general is leading this legal challenge. It's not difficult to figure out what this is about. This is about the coal-burning and coal-producing states basically wanting to keep doing what they're doing. This is at the heart of global warming, isn't this? Do we have global warming deniers on the Supreme Court? I know we do amongst the Republican Party and amongst the Republican presidential candidates, but what's your understanding of why these justices had this ruling, since at the end of the day, it's going to block efforts to deal with global warming?
Well, again, they didn't issue an opinion, so we don't know for sure what they were thinking. But we do know the legal standard under which they would evaluate this kind of request. And, you know, it could mean a few different things. Again, it certainly means that the conservative majority of the court thinks that the opponents of the Clean Power Plan have some chance of winning. They wouldn't grant, the court wouldn't grant a stay if they had no chance at all of winning the case. It's not a signal that they will definitely rule against the law. They may have issued the stay mainly because they were persuaded that there would be great harm to the coal industry and to the states that oppose the rule if they had to begin complying with it while fighting it in court. Right? The legal standard is they have to show that they would be harmed irreparably by having to comply with the law while they're challenging it. And, you know, maybe the Supreme Court was motivated principally by this, by an idea that if there's some chance that they're going to win, then you know, we shouldn't make them suffer irreparable harm in the meantime. You know, the industry was citing estimates that under the Clean Power Plan, over 50 coal-fired power plants in the country would be shut down, that kind of thing. And if the justices were sympathetic to those kinds of arguments, which I think are just wrong, but that, again, the justices didn't even consider this for very long. They very, very quickly issued this stay. Maybe that was, you know, in some sense, in deference to claims that there would be irreparable harm to industry and to the large number of states that were actually you know, appealing and opposing the rule.
And again, I'm speaking with David Akush, who's the Managing Director of Public Citizens Climate Program. He's an expert on consumer product safety, financial protection, access to justice and money in politics, and has testified before Congress on environmental protection and climate change. And, of course, it seems a bit of an irony, since the Republicans so often, particularly Ted Cruz, make disdainful remarks about Harvard law professors, that Lawrence Tribe, the Harvard law professor, made the arguments on behalf of the coal companies and the trade association that represents them. And he told the justices that they should act to stop a targeted attack on the coal industry. So that seems to have resonated.
It's really strange to be hearing that. I mean, first of all, I think as a legal matter, I'm a lawyer and I've actually taught administrative law, which is really what these environmental cases are about. And I don't think that Professor Tribe's arguments make much sense, with all respect. I don't think there's any constitutional problem whatsoever with the Clean Power Plan. But also, it's odd just to hear him echoing this industry rhetoric about a war on coal. The coal industry has been dying for years on its own. Coal-fired power plants are old, they're dirty, they're expensive, and they are losing out, and they've been losing out for years, in part to natural gas, and increasingly now to renewables. If you were going to start from scratch right now and build our electricity infrastructure, it is much cheaper and much more efficient, not to mention much cleaner, better for the environment, better for your health, to build it based on renewables. To build wind or to build solar is far cheaper than building a coal plant or even a natural gas plant. The only reason why electricity produced with coal or natural gas is cheaper in the places where it's still cheaper, and again, that's changing very rapidly, is because the infrastructure's already been built, because we already have the power plants. To take this a step further, this is the reason why actually fixing climate change doesn't necessarily have to cost us a tremendous amount of money. All that infrastructure is getting very old. Right? The average age of a coal-fired power plant in this country is over 42 years. The expected life when they're built is only 30 years. We're going to have to replace all of this infrastructure pretty soon anyway. It would barely cost any more to replace it with renewables instead of more fossil fuels. And we would just we would do that, and we would do it on a slightly quicker schedule, and it would, you know, take us most of the way to solving our climate crisis. it would create an enormous number of jobs, and it would save an enormous number of lives in terms of the air pollution that would be cleaned up from getting less of our electricity from coal.
But specifically, this EPA regulation that issued last summer requires states to make major cuts in greenhouse gas pollution by cutting emissions from existing power plants by a third by 2030 from a 2005 baseline, and particularly by closing hundreds of these heavily polluting coal-fired plants and then switching, as you say, to natural gas, which is cheap and plentiful now, and wind and solar. So it's just on the surface seems perfectly reasonable. And I'm just curious to know why these free marketeers what possible arguments they can have. I mean, they always talk about creative destruction, and that's the nature of capitalist entrepreneurship. And this is a case of creative destruction, isn't it? The old has to be phased out as quickly as possible for the new to come in. And you just made the case that the old, they're all past their due dates at any rate to be demolished, and the alternatives are cheaper and much better for the environment.
Well, that's certainly what is going on here. Now, you don't hear the CEOs of coal companies saying, look, our industry's dying anyway. They would rather point the finger and deny reality, right? So they instead accuse the EPA, they accuse the president of waging a war on them and shutting them down, because I think that's just a more comfortable story for them to tell. And unfortunately, it's a story that's backed with a lot of money because they're making money by digging up rocks in the ground and selling them to people to burn. Their story is backed with a lot of money, a lot of lawyers, a lot of lobbyists. And it gives them a lot of political power, unfortunately. But yeah, their industry is dying, and it needs to die a little bit faster. And really, that's all that the EPA Clean Power Plan would do, is in some ways kind of codify existing trends, maybe nudge them a little bit forward. This is really a pathway that we're already on.
So what about the clean energy lobby that we see on television now promoting natural gas and its virtues? Do they have political muscle too? I mean, is this a case of the new having enough political muscle to silence the old?
Well, natural gas has some political muscle. I think that for a little while now, people have been talking about natural gas as a potential bridge between coal, sort of the dirtiest, most carbon-polluting sources of energy, and the cleanest renewables. But I think increasingly now there's a recognition, though, that natural gas really isn't a bridge. It's more of a detour. It really doesn't make any sense to build a new natural gas infrastructure, for example, to replace our coal infrastructure, because we need to end essentially all carbon emissions from fossil fuels as rapidly as possible. So as soon as we stop burning coal to generate electricity, the next task is to immediately stop burning natural gas. Why would we build new natural gas plants right now when we need to shut them down as quickly as possible? I think there's an increasing recognition of that. I think that there was an evolution even in the EPA's thinking from the time it initially proposed the Clean Power Plan to when it finalized the Clean Power Plan. The role of natural gas is somewhat diminished in the final rule, and I think that the agency basically realized this, that we should be aiming toward increasing the role of renewables above all. And energy efficiency, and that's the big piece that we haven't mentioned yet, which is just reducing the amount of power that we use to do the exact same things, right? Without actually having to change your activities or reduce what you're doing, do them more efficiently in one way, whether it's by having more efficient appliances or by having your home better insulated, your buildings better insulated, that sort of thing. Just using less power overall, those are the real pathways to fixing the climate problem.
Well, of course, here in Los Angeles, we have a massive methane leak that's been going on since October. And whatever advantages natural gas burning power generators have, they're offset by a leakage of methane which is such a virulent global warming gas. So any leaks along the grid and from the fracking of these wells and the wellheads and even all the way up to the pipes to the house, because we often smell gas around the house. And frankly, there's no national inventory on the leakage of methane across the entire natural gas grid. So it may end up, because of the methane leakage, be whatever benefits to the environment they have may be offset by those leaks. So I get your point.
No, that's right. And I'm glad you mentioned it. I mean, I was basically saying that even if we buy the argument that natural gas is less harmful to the climate than coal, we shouldn't be shifting that direction anyway, because we should be going straight to renewables. But you're right. Increasingly, we have reason to doubt that natural gas is even any better. Right? In the short term, methane is actually much more potent than carbon. And the short term is what we're concerned about. Right? We need to fix our climate problem immediately. You know, in the next few years, the next few decades, and we can't release a lot of methane into the environment on the basis that in the long term it's not as harmful to the climate as carbon. And as you're pointing out, there are leaks all up and down the chain of natural gas. And essentially every study that comes out looking at the problem finds that it's worse and worse than we thought. It may well be that methane's actually far worse. And burning natural gas is far worse than burning carbon for climate change.
Just in closing, what can be done then, given what the Supreme Court is doing and the fear that they are reactionaries, if not global warming deniers, as we've seen at the highest levels in the Republican Party?
Well, I think they're on a sort of local and state level. The states are certainly free to keep moving forward, writing their plans to comply with the EPA rule. The way the rule works is that the EPA set goals for every state, but the states make their own plans for how to comply with them. There's no reason a state can't go forward with making its own plan and to meet the goals that the EPA set, or even to exceed them. And states should do that, and citizens should encourage their state governments to do that. And then again, on an individual level, individual citizens should be doing everything they can to encourage a quick transition to renewables and to improve energy efficiency as much as possible so we use less power.
Well, David Akush, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with David Akush, who's the Managing Director of Public Citizens Climate Program, an expert on consumer product safety and financial protection, access to justice and money in politics. He has testified before Congress on environmental protection and climate change. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Bye.